And I'm Rebecca.
And we are tour guides here with Tour Guide Tell All, our podcast all about some of the more interesting aspects of American history. You're listening to this episode in May, which is a very special month. Rebecca, you want to tell our listeners why it's so special?
Yes. So May 2020, when we're putting this out, May 8th is the 75th anniversary of VE Day, Victory in Europe, which is the end of the Second World War in Europe. And the 75th anniversary, unfortunately, with all this COVID craziness, we are not getting a chance to have sort of public appreciation and ceremonies for our veterans to mark this big anniversary. And so we thought that we would do our part, our small part, to honor our veterans and talk about World War II. And so this entire month, we are talking about different stories on the podcast about figures that have to do with World War II, monuments in Washington that have to do with World War II. So we're kind of doing a whole theme this entire month around the end of the Second World War.
If you're listening to this podcast and you're interested in what we're talking about here, kind of commemorating or remembering World War II, not only will we have special episodes of this podcast, but if you follow us on Facebook at Free Tours by Foot or check out our Instagram and YouTube pages, we're going to have some special content, including some very cool oral histories we've been collecting this week. So we hope that you will check that out. I think like a lot of people, I have World War II in my family. Both my grandfather served and my great-grandfather actually served World War II as well. And so even though they're no longer here, this was kind of an exciting year to commemorate that 75th anniversary. And so I'm sad that we're not getting to do some of these commemorations that we in DC get to enjoy so much at the World War II Memorial and other places. So getting to do some special episodes of the podcast is really nice. And today we're going to talk about something that's very near and dear to my heart, which is Arlington National Cemetery. That's where my grandfather and great-grandfather are laid to rest. Arlington's one of my favorite places to give tours of. I'm sure you feel the same way, Rebecca.
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite places to give tours. And to be just generally, it's lovely and I miss it. And it's, yeah, there's a lot of history in general at Arlington. Sort of all of American history has some representation at Arlington somewhere. But obviously a lot of World War II history is there as well. So we're going to basically do a brief kind of overview of Arlington, at least as far as World War II is concerned. And then we're going to talk about two people that are buried at Arlington that are really, I think, famous and interesting and sort of a great sort of tie into our World War II month of coverage.
As sort of a little introduction, though, if you're listening to this and you're not 100% sure what Arlington is, Arlington National Cemetery is some of our most hallowed ground in the nation. It is a national military cemetery. It was started as such during the Civil War. The first service member to be laid to rest there was in May of 1864, Private William Chrisman. It starts out primarily as a Civil War cemetery, but today, of course, we have expanded that to embody all American wars. So there's actually service members from every American armed conflict, going back to the American Revolution all the way to today. One of the most important things I like to make sure that visitors to Arlington know and understand is that it's still an active cemetery today. So today, 30 to 35 funerals are happening on any given day. Even during all of this craziness with the virus and the cemetery being closed to the public, they're still doing services, they're still doing burials at Arlington. So they take that mission of honoring those who served and their family members very, very seriously. Today, it's a little over 400,000 of our service members and their loved ones who are buried at Arlington National Cemetery. So it's an incredible place to visit. And it really is rich in history, but I think especially World War II.
Yeah, super. There's a lot of, and we'll go through them kind of really, some of the more notable people that are buried at Arlington, but they've got memorials to the Battle of the Bulge. There's a memorial to the 3rd Infantry Division, the Canadian Cross, which recognizes the bravery of American service members who fought with Canada before the United States was involved in the war. There is a statue of Sir John Dill, who is a British field marshal. That's pretty prominent when you come into the cemetery. There is so many World War II veterans that are buried at Arlington. We could list them probably for days, but some of the famous ones. You want to start? Or should I start?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, the cemetery has thousands and thousands of World War II veterans, including my grandfather and great-grandfather. But when I'm on tour, recently especially, I've been mentioning Justice John Paul Stevens, who just passed away last year. But a lot of people think that he's buried there just because he was a Supreme Court justice. But he actually joined up right before Pearl Harbor. He was awarded the Navy Star. So he was a decorated war hero from World War II long before he ever served on the bench. There's also a civil rights hero, Medgar Evers. A lot of people are surprised that Evers is buried at Arlington, but he, like many African-Americans, even when the service was segregated, he served just like Joe Lewis, the famous boxer. I always like to point out some of the Tuskegee Airmen when we're at Arlington National Cemetery. There's a lot of, I think, kind of pop culture figures at Arlington too.
Yes, I always forget that Dashiell Hammett is buried at Arlington. Like, I know who he is, I know who he served, but I always, like, it just, Dashiell Hammett wrote The Maltese Falcon, and you don't associate him necessarily with being buried at Arlington.
But he also, Dashiell Hammett, I just have to mention, primarily he's the World War One generation.
Yes.
Is really his time period. But when World War II started, even though he was in his 40s and really sort of past the prime age, he requested to join back up. He didn't go serve overseas in World War II, but he, it was really important to him to sort of join back up and serve again. So I kind of love that. And you see that a lot with this generation, that either you have these World War One guys who wanted to join back up for World War II, even if they stayed stateside, or you have these World War II vets who are young who'll continue to serve in Korea, and some of them even into Vietnam as well.
Yes. Glenn Miller, the famous big band leader, he's not buried at Arlington. In fact, he dies in a plane crash and his body's not recovered, but there is a stone, a headstone for his memory there, what's called a cenotaph in official Arlington speak. The Joe Lewis, you mentioned, the boxer, is buried there. A lot of early astronauts were, most of the early astronauts, NASA drew very heavily, as you might expect, from fighter pilots. So Gus Grissom and Roger Chaffee of the Apollo 1 disaster, John Glenn, all of them World War II veterans. You've got a bunch that you may never have heard of, but there are a lot of early astronauts, Richard Gordon, Stu Rusa, all of whom served in the Second World War, buried at Arlington as well. The actor Lee Marvin, and Hollywood's more Becca's area than it is mine, but he's buried right next to Joe Lewis because they were apparently friends in real life, which I find to be delightful.
Both Lee Marvin and Joe Lewis buried in the same section of a gentleman we're going to talk about a little bit later. I like to mention Charles Durning, which he's an actor who, if you have seen movies like Tootsie and these sort of like kind of classic 80s and 90s comedies, is always sort of this cartoonish character. But he was a 3-time Purple Heart recipient from World War II. So I am a big movie buff. I could list movies all day that Charles Durning was in. But if you go to IMDb or look it up, you might be surprised because he's sort of grandfather figure in so many movies of my generation. But like so many of his generation, at 18, he went and served. I could see Rebecca just Googled a picture of Charles Durning to get a visual of what he looked like.
I really, really did.
And there's more and more and more. I do want to mention, when we're talking about World War II history, I think it's important at Arlington, I think it's important to mention the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier had started with the First World War. At the time, right, that was the Great War, the war to end all wars. They had one unidentified American service member laid to rest at a special tomb to honor all those who'd gone off and not returned home. And the hope, right, the idea was that would be a special tomb for that war, and there would never be a war on that scale again, except World War II comes along. So it is almost a no question for Arlington that after World War II ends, that of course they're going to add an unknown soldier. That won't happen though until 1958. Part of that is a bigger effort to recover and identify World War II service members who've been killed in action, but they will inter an unknown soldier for World War II in 1958. President Dwight D. Eisenhower will preside over that ceremony. That is, of course, very fitting given Eisenhower's role during the Second World War. I think, to, when we talk about World War II at Arlington, it's maybe good to note that the scale of World War II, the casualties, plus the thousands and thousands and thousands of veterans, 16 million men and 300,000 women who served in uniform from the United States in World War II. And many of those would go, many of those people would go on to live long lives. So what starts to happen in the 1980s and 1990s is you start having many of the service members who are qualified, they're eligible to be laid to rest at Arlington because of their service, because of the medals of distinction they were awarded. And Arlington starts to fill up. It really starts to have one of the biggest space problems it's had up to this point with the World War II generation. It's going to really force Arlington to make some changes to how the cemeteries operated, to kind of have better record keeping, better use of the land to help them expand to their current size. Space is still a big issue at Arlington today, and it's going to continue to be a pressing issue, but it really comes to head with this World War II generation as they start to take more and more space in the cemetery.
Yes, absolutely. And that's an ongoing struggle that Arlington continues to sort of try to figure out to this day, how best to sort of honor our veterans but maintain the integrity of the cemetery and expand, and it's sort of very much ongoing.
When I take groups to Arlington, one of the first things I talk about early on is the Medal of Honor. You want to tell listeners about the Medal of Honor?
Oh, yes, very much. So the Medal of Honor is the highest medal that the United States bestows. It was created in 1861, so in the Civil War. And to date, like we're in May of 2020, just over 3,500 medals of honor have been awarded. So it's very limited. It is for bravery and gallantry, a conspicuous gallantry above and beyond the call of duty. It is, like I mentioned, the highest honor that can be bestowed on someone. It is the only, so if you picture someone in military uniform, they have all their medals on their chest, right? They've got the different medals and things worn on the side of their chest. The Medal of Honor is actually worn around the neck. It's the only one to do so. So the recipient wears it around the neck. It is bestowed by the President of the United States. And this, I feel like, is particularly neat. The Medal of Honor, wearing the Medal of Honor, entitles the wearer to be saluted by the President of the United States rather than the other way around. So it is considered the highest honor. Over 400 Medal of Honor recipients are buried at Arlington from across American history, but there are over 50 of them from the Second World War. And we're going to talk about two of them.
I always like to mention to my guests with the Medal of Honor that 65% of those medals are awarded posthumously. So more often than not, we're talking about someone who has given their life in defense of this country. So many times at Arlington, when you're looking at these markers and you can tell a recipient is a Medal of Honor, has been bestowed the Medal of Honor because they have gold lettering and usually the emblem of the Medal of Honor or the words Medal of Honor on their grave marker. But when you see that, it really recognizes somebody usually who has either given their life or put their life at great risk to save the lives of others. And it's interesting because the two people we're going to talk about on this episode both survived World War II. I don't know if that's a spoiler. They both survived, but it's sort of incredible because when you hear about what they do, the fact that they come back is really, really astonishing to me, truly. But the fact that there are more than 50 Medal of Honor recipients just from World War II alone at Arlington National Cemetery, I think is really incredible.
We're going to have to do a Medal of Honor episode at some point. I have like tons of Medal of Honor trivia. I'm ready.
I have to do a whole season on the Medal of Honor.
Yes, I have plenty of Medal of Honor trivia. I'm ready to go. Medal of Honor Day is in March. They bring Medal of Honor recipients to Arlington. Not obviously so much this March, but and they have a ceremony. It's really, really great. We're going to start with Audie, right? You ready?
Yeah.
Let's do this. So when I first started giving tours, I mentioned to my dad, who's a history buff as well, he said, you have to tell people the Audie Murphy story. And I said, Dad, no one remembers or cares who Audie Murphy was. And my dad was right. I was very wrong. people ask all the time. He's one of the most requested. When I give tours at Arlington, he's one of the most requested things that people ask about. Even if they're not even on my tour, people will literally walk up to me in the middle of Arlington Cemetery and ask me where Audie Murphy is buried. So he's super important.
You know, I have to jump in here and just say he's from Texas, which is where I'm from.
I was going to get to that, yes.
And Audie Murphy, though, for Texans especially, he is a national hero. I mean, he is one of the most important people from Texas. It's like Sam Houston and then like Audie Murphy, like that's the list. He's so, so important. We have such state pride for what Audie Murphy does. So even before I ever started tour guiding, that was a name when we learned about World War II growing up. That was the name that was like, I think even more than Eisenhower or MacArthur or anybody else, Marshall, it was always sort of like Audie Murphy. But I would agree with you. I think he's the number one person I get asked about when I take anybody to the cemetery.
Yes. Audie Murphy, born in Texas, as Becca mentioned, and my Texas geography is not really great, but he's born apparently in a small town called Kingston, which I guess is like northeastern Texas.
Yeah, it's a small, tiny town.
And he's born to sharecroppers. They have no money. He's the ninth of 10 children. And his father abandons the family. His mother dies when he's quite young. And so we're obviously in the midst of the Great Depression. There's not a lot of money. And Audie Murphy leaves school to go to work. Now, I'm going to mention his birthday, and normally we don't do dates a lot on this pod, but this I think is going to be, it's going to come up again and again and be kind of important. Audie Murphy was born on June 20th, 1925. Now that's going to be important in a couple of different ways. So 1925, ask yourself and get out your little calculator. On December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, how many years old is Audie Murphy? And the answer that you're going to come up with is he's 16. Okay. He wants to sign up that next spring as Americans ramping up to getting involved in the Second World War. Audie Murphy wants to sign up, but obviously he's 16. And he also, he's underage, he's also underweight, which is not unusual. We're coming out of the Great Depression. A lot of people just did not have the calories in their diet to sort of make weight as far as the military goes. And so there's estimates that 35% of the men who try to sign up in 1942 are gonna be sort of undersized. And Audie Murphy is one of them. He goes to the Navy and the Marines to sign up. And they basically pat him on the head and say, oh, honey, like, go home, like, come back when you're older. And he really has always wanted to serve in the military. And so he goes back, and him and his sister amend his birth certificate to age him a little faster than he normally would.
Amend is a really nice way of saying falsifying documents for government use.
Yes. They falsify documents. And, you know, the Social Security Administration was pretty new back then. Things get lost. It's a thing. She actually signs an affidavit saying that he's a year older than he actually is, which is, like, not really legal at all. But she says that he wasn't born in 1925. He was born in 1924. And so magically that means that by June of 1942, he's turned 18 and can serve. Now, we obviously know that he's just turned 17, but he goes off and he serves. And Audie Murphy proves to be fearless. He serves through the rest of the European war. Like, he starts in North Africa, he's in Casablanca, he's in Italy, he gets involved in the in Anzio, he's wounded in Italy at least once, he's in Naples for a while, and he's gonna be in France as well. He's at first in the south of France, and he actually gets injured. He gets shot in the hip by a sniper. He takes out the sniper, but he has to recover. The wound turns gangrenous, and so there's a long recovery period. It takes him out of action through the end of 1944. And he finally rejoins his unit in mid-January of 1945. Now, my supposition is that basically the day that he could medically like run and wield a weapon, he was insisting that he be put back in the field.
Which kind of tells you something, I think, about Audie Murphy, because at that point with that sort of injury, he probably could have transferred to something a little less dangerous. He probably could have gotten, he could have been a desk jockey. He could have gotten something out of the way, but he definitely wants to be back in the thick of it. This is not a guy who's made for the sidelines.
No, and by this time, he's already received several medals. He's received the Purple Heart. He will eventually receive 3 Purple Hearts, which is incredible. He's been promoted several battlefield commissions, and he gets sent back to his unit, and they are sort of locked down in something called the Colmar Pocket. This is going to be mid-January in 1945, and the Colmar Pocket is in the mountains, and it's in an area of France called Alsace, which is the border basically between France and Germany. Very hotly contested area. The Germans are very reluctant to give this area up. And Audie Murphy gets back. He gets wounded again in both legs and receives a second bronze oak leaf cluster to add to his Purple Heart. So more medals. He then, as they are awaiting reinforcements on the 26th of January, 1945, he's made commander of his company, Company B. And in the midst of the battle, and battles go on for days, in the midst of this battle, the Germans score a direct hit on a tank. And basically the tank gets lit on fire, and obviously the crew has to abandon it because it's on fire. And Audie Murphy orders his men to retreat out of the area they're in to the cover of trees behind them. And to sort of cover his men as they are retreating, he's going to hold off the Germans on his own with his rifle as the men retreat. Once he's also on his radio directing artillery fire to the German lines. And once he runs out of ammunition and his weapon, he gets into the burning tank, which is, again, on fire.
And probably at any point about to blow.
And it, yes, probably could blow up at any moment. And also there's artillery happening like all over the place. He gets into the burning tank, and the tanks have a 50 caliber machine gun. He takes the machine gun and starts firing at the Germans. And he does this for an hour, all on his own. While the tank is on fire, he gets injured in the leg. He kills over 50 Germans, giving the men under his command a chance to escape. He stops when he runs out of ammunition, and he then is going to direct his men. He refuses to get his wound treated, disregarding his own injury until the Germans have been completely repelled. And then he insists on remaining with his men while his wounds are treated. And for this bravery, he is going to be awarded the Medal of Honor.
I feel like I want to quote the last line of his Medal of Honor citation, because it's just such an incredible story. Second Lieutenant Murphy's indomitable courage and his refusal to give an inch of ground saved his company from possible encirclement and destruction and enabled it to hold the woods, which had been the enemy's objective. So he single-handedly saves an entire unit. He single-handedly keeps the objective of the Germans at bay, right? Keeps them from getting into these woods. And he manages to do this and survive. That's what's so incredible to me, not only to save so many lives, but to also be able to escape with his own.
And my favorite part about this is when he's asked about this, he says, well, the Germans were firing at my friends, as if that makes complete sense and explains everything. So, you know, he's promoted again to first lieutenant. He is awarded the Legion of Merit. And by the end of the war, he goes all the way through to VE Day. He eventually is going to be sort of pulled back a little from the front lines. But by the end of the war, he has over 90 confirmed kills. He has been awarded basically every medal that the United States has, and some we don't. He's decorated for valor by the governments of both France and Belgium. His chest, if you see a picture of him, his chest is full of medals, over 30 of them. He is the most decorated American during the Second World War. And in the course of all of this, he becomes famous. And Audie Murphy's not I mean, he's not bad looking, but he's not really good looking. He's very everyman, you know? But they take pictures of him. He's in Life magazine. They do a big photo spread on him and becomes sort of the representative of the courage of the army, particularly in the European campaign. And he really is famous. And it also is worth mentioning that because he lies about his age, he doesn't turn 20 until June of 1945. So he's a teenager for all of this. Like, imagine that. It's incredible.
I always think of when you see him on the cover of Life magazine, and we'll put an image in the show notes, which you can find on our Free Tours by Foot blog. But when you look at him, I think at the end of the war, right, this young man so full of youth and hope, with all those medals on his chest, I think people looked at that and it was everybody's son. You know, yes. Everybody saw their son, their brother, their husband, their loved one who didn't come back, or maybe did and maybe didn't come with the full chest of medals. But he has that look of like the every man. Yes. And because he's so young, I think he really embodies the fact that when I think a lot of us think about World War II, we're thinking about our grandparents. But these men were 16, 17, 18, many, many, many of them. They're young. And as a lot of people say, they leave as boys and they come back as men. And I think you just see that so much in that picture of him, what he represented to Americans across the country.
Yes. And he comes home, and there is some talk about him like joining a unit in the Pacific because they're still fighting in the Pacific. That does not happen. And what's a guy to do? His war is over, but write his autobiography. I mean, obviously at 21, we all write our autobiographies, right? And
he's got a little bit more to say than the average 21-year-old.
That's true. That's fair. He calls it To Hell and Back. And Hollywood eventually because he's so famous, Hollywood wants to make a movie out of his life story. However, they can't find someone to play him. He's not a big guy. And so they look around and they eventually decide, hey, who better to play Audie Murphy than Audie Murphy?
And so I have to mention, they had their eye on an actor named Tony Curtis, who some of you may know if you watch old movies.
Sweet smile
but Tony
success.
Curtis had broken his leg filming another movie. So they were worried that he wouldn't be able to do the stunts and it would be too long for the recovery. And I think that's when they were like, well, you know, Audie Murphy's not a bad looking guy. Definitely looks like Audie Murphy. So they cast him to play himself. He, at this point, was a little bit of a struggling actor. So it wasn't that he had no ambition of being on the screen, but he's definitely green at it. What I do find it funny is by the time they get around to making the movie, he is pushing 30, but he's portraying himself as like 17, 18, 19.
Yeah. Who couldn't look more like Audie Murphy than Audie Murphy? And the point that I love to make on my tours is Audie Murphy gets to go to Hollywood and play himself in the movie version, which I feel pretty strongly, this is literally the goal of every human being on earth. Like, we all want to play ourselves in the movie version. And he sort of improbably goes on to a second career in the movies. He does a lot of country and western movies. He makes about 40 of them. He's got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
He does The Red Badge of Courage, which is a Civil War movie, which I sort of love. Kind of this World War II vet going back and doing this kind of Civil War classic.
And the other thing that I really like to point out about Audie Murphy is he also suffers very publicly with what we would talk today and call it post-traumatic stress. Back then they called it battle fatigue, but he suffers from insomnia. He sort of bouts with depression. He sleeps with a gun under his pillow. And at one point he gets addicted to a pill. And in true sort of Audie Murphy fashion, the way that he decides to break his addiction is he locks himself into a hotel room for a week, refuses to come out, and then breaks his addiction, which is not the doctor recommended way to do that, but proves to you sort of what a badass he is. And I always emphasize this on my tours because I think it's super important. Audie Murphy does a lot, having struggled himself with mental health issues connected to his service. He does a lot to shine a light on that sort of mental health with veterans. And in those days, you know, having battle fatigue was considered weakness, you know, sort of not manly. And this is a different generation, the World War II generation. They didn't want to talk about this. But Audie Murphy is unassailably masculine and tough. Like, you can't call Audie Murphy a weakling. And so he uses this position that he has as sort of really a famous guy and a very, you know, obviously very masculine man to sort of shine a light on a lot of veterans' mental health issues that otherwise were not getting talked about. And I think that's of particular importance and very praiseworthy for Audie Murphy. So that's one of the things that I really emphasize.
That's one of my favorite parts of his story, is his willingness to talk publicly about the battle fatigue, to be honest about what he was going through, sleeping with a pistol under his pillow, watching news footage and finding himself reduced to tears. He goes to Congress and basically uses that fame that he has, all those medals on his chest, and says, look, there has to be more government support. You can't send young men off to do these things and then expect them to come back and forget. That's what a lot of the mental health service at that time really led up to, was like, just forget it. You're back home. You're safe. You survived. Forget it. And he goes and he says, we can't forget. I can never forget those that didn't come back home. And so his willingness to really push Congress, I think, is so savvy too, because who's going to say no to the most decorated combat veteran of the Second World War? You can't. You can't vote against funding at that point when he comes before your congressional committee.
Right, with all of his medals and looking every inch the part of the soldier, you know, like, it's really important. I think he paves the way in an important way to the next generation. Vietnam generation is going to talk much more openly about post-traumatic stress and battle fatigue and things of that nature. And I think that that's going to be, he does a really important role in sort of making those conversations something that we talk about.
And he himself will go and meet with Korean War vets and Vietnam veterans personally to talk to veterans from those wars, which I think is so important too. He sees himself connected to these men that are coming after him.
Yes. Audie Murphy dies tragically young. He's in a plane crash in 1971 over the Shenandoah Mountains in Virginia, and he had wanted to be buried at Arlington National Cemetery. And the Army had thought about making a big, huge headstone, sort of a memorial to him at Arlington, and he absolutely did not want that. He wanted to be buried, as he put it, with his guys. He wants to be just alongside everybody else in, you know, a government issue headstone. And he also did not want special attention paid to his Medal of Honor. However, the military was smart enough to realize that he was going to want to, that people were going to want to visit him. And so they put him in an accessible spot right behind the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier so that people could pay their respects to Audie Murphy.
And normally, if we're looking at a grave marker that has a Medal of Honor, that is for a Medal of Honor recipient, you would see that gold leaf. And Arlington did tell his second wife that he would be entitled to the gold leaf for his Medal of Honor. And she said no, that he would have wanted it. He said plain, inconspicuous. That's what he wanted. And so she refused the gold leaf. So it's very, it's interesting to me. It's obviously in a very accessible spot. When you go to Arlington on almost any given day, there's flowers and flags, and people often leave remembrances there, even during quieter times of year. But otherwise, it really does look like just any other service member. And I think that really speaks to the humility of Audie Murphy. The cemetery says that it is the second most visited individual gravesite after President John F. Kennedy. I don't know how they can track that per se, but it would not surprise me at all.
I'm sure that it is true, but I also wonder how they track that. Like, there's no, like, counter to fit. Anyway.
And I say I have been fortunate enough to be with honor flights and veterans groups that come to Arlington. And he's located, Audie Murphy, right across from the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And anytime we bring veterans to come see the changing of the guard, what they almost always want to do first is go see Audie Murphy. He just means so much to those that served, not just in World War II, but those who've served subsequently. I think he really embodies the spirit of sacrifice, service, of camaraderie, right? Putting the well-being of the men you serve with before your own. He just encapsulates that. And then to be so humble and so sort of non-egotistical when he comes back is really incredible. This is not a man who is seeking fame per se. He's in movies, but he sees it as a career, not as a way to just be famous. To Hell and Back is not a bad flick. I would encourage people to watch it if you haven't. Or coming up, it'll be Memorial Day soon by the time you listen to this podcast, I believe. So it's usually a good time. You want to watch a couple World War II flicks around Memorial Day. To Hell and Back is a pretty good one. We have Audie Murphy, kind of a young whippersnapper as the war begins, but someone else that perhaps we want to talk about?
So the other person we want to talk about is not a young whippersnapper, is the opposite, actually. Jimmy Doolittle is buried not actually all that far from Audie Murphy.
Very close.
Jimmy Doolittle is famous for the Doolittle Raid, but he actually was nationally known well before the Second World War. Jimmy Doolittle is an early aviation pioneer. He's actually the first American to get a PhD in aeronautical engineering from MIT. And the reason he does is because he was in the Army Air Corps, and he wanted to get a master's degree. And so they gave him 2 years, and he completes his master's degree in one. And so what's a guy to do but stick around for another year and get a PhD? So he's kind of that guy. He does a lot of very early pioneering flights. He's a very early advocate of instrument flying. So we're not relying on seeing what's going on around you, but actually using your instruments to fly a plane. During the war, he actually leads a sort of revolution of fighter pilot and fighter tactics. But what he is known for, sort of most importantly, he's put back to active duty in 1940 when the Second World War is looming. And when Pearl Harbor is hit in the end of 1941, Franklin Roosevelt really wants to hit the Japanese back. And Jimmy Doolittle, at this point, he's well over 40. He's the age, military age, where he should be retired or at least having a desk job, but he wants to really serve. And so he organizes something that has gone down in history as the Doolittle Raid. What they're going to do is the objective of the raid is to hit Japan on the home islands. So go to Japan and bomb Tokyo and Kyoto and some of their major cities.
You're saying this like it's, you know, they're just going to go and bomb Japan.
Right.
Like it's just a thing that you could do. But we're talking about 1941, early 1942. And the capability to do that is not really there, right?
Correct, yes. We have all, Becca and I, and probably everybody listening to this, grown up with the idea of American military supremacy. And we're, you know, the military leader, and we have global reach. First of all, in 1942, global reach doesn't exist yet. Their technology just isn't there. And secondly, we're not, like, we don't have military supremacy by a long shot, particularly early on in the war. And one of the things that sort of people forget about when you're flying a plane to drop bombs on somewhere, you got to make sure you have enough fuel to get where you're going. And then, and this is the very critical part, you have to make sure you have enough fuel to get back.
They're not going to let you stop and refuel after you've dropped some bombs.
Right. There's nowhere on Japan, our enemy, to like refuel. That's not really a good option there. And obviously, we don't have a base anywhere near Japan because they're the enemy and they're all the way over there. And so the idea becomes that we're going to, the Doolittle Raiders are going to take a carrier group, the USS Hornet, one other aircraft carrier. They've got destroyers and cruisers, and this is an entire aircraft carrier group. And about 600 miles off of the coast of Japan, the USS Hornet is going to, they're going to be 16 planes, and these are medium bombers, so they're not fighter jets. These are not going to be your nimble fighter jets. These are going to be 5-member crew bomber, 16 of them. So if you do the math, that's 80 guys. And Doolittle recruits them sort of particularly, he recruits them individually and tells them all that we're taking a chance here. This is, I don't expect you all to survive. And if he tells the guys, like, this is the mission, if this is not your thing, no hard feelings. I promise it will, if you don't want to participate, if this is too much for you, I promise it will not affect your careers. We'll just go our separate ways. All 80 of the guys are like, nope, we're in this. Let's do it. And so in April of 1942, the Doolittle Raid takes off. they're flying all day. They take off very early in the morning. They get to Japan in the middle of the day, and they drop bombs on a couple of different Japanese cities, mostly Tokyo. And the Japanese were so convinced that we could not get to them, that they were safe, that Japan, we were way too far, we did not have the technology to get to the home islands, that when the Japanese see our planes overhead, they assume that they're their planes doing some kind of, you know, rally morale boosting demonstration. And so a lot of Japanese go out and sort of start waving.
And there's no alarms, there's no kind of the sirens or anything, that they really don't believe that American planes can get to them. So they don't have the sort of defense system that like Germany had at that time to warn people and bunkers and all of that sort of thing.
Right, exactly. They had not put any money into air defense because, again, they were convinced we could not get to them. And so they don't really realize that they're American until the bombs literally start dropping. And they're like, wait a second, this isn't how this is supposed to go. The Doolittle Raiders continue. They don't go backwards towards the Hornet, the USS Hornet. They wouldn't have made it. So they continue to China. And the idea is they're supposed to land at an airbase in China. Now, China in those days is not communist yet. They're nationalists. They're an ally of the US. And they know that we're coming. But we're not coordinating with them because this is supposed to be a secret mission. We're not coordinating quite as well as we could have. The Chinese don't realize the Doolittle raid is coming as quickly as it is. They don't turn on their homing beacons and their lanterns and things. And so the Americans can't find the runway and have to eject out of all 16 of these planes. So all of them, one of them kind of crash lands into Soviet Russia, and the pilots are all going to be taken prisoner by the Soviets, which is definitely how you treat an ally. And three of the men die in the crash, but most of them actually live and are all rescued and brought back to the Americans. The Doolittle raid is an overwhelming success. Militarily, not as much. It kills about 50 people, does some damage, injures a few hundred, but psychologically, it is hugely effective. It tells the Japanese that we can hit them where they live, we can get to them, and it forces them to put their carrier groups in a different formation, sort of up by Alaska, to make sure that we can't do this again. And so they are forced to deploy resources that they don't really have to sort of defense in a way that they had not calculated on. In the United States, this is a humongous morale booster, and it's really difficult to oversell how much this boosts morale. We had just been hit at home. Pearl Harbor had been attacked. A lot of Americans are feeling vulnerable and depressed, and this really just sort of boosts morale in a massively huge way that sort of propels us into the later parts of the 1942. And so Doolittle's raid is a huge success. Doolittle himself doesn't think so, though.
He's convinced. He's got a problem because he lost a few aircraft on that mission.
He lost all these planes, and these are brand new. Like, they're less than 2 years old, right? And so they're like the top of the line technology, and this is bad. Like, you're not supposed to crash the planes. Like, he did return with most of the guys, so that's obviously really good. But these are new planes, and so he actually expected that he'd get court-martialed for this.
But he did not.
He did not know. Spoiler alert. He's immediately given not only one, but two promotions. He's promoted to Brigadier General, like skipping a step. And when he's back in the United States, Franklin Roosevelt himself bestows the Medal of Honor on Jimmy Doolittle and sort of cements Doolittle's fame to the point where they made a movie out of it not that long ago, right?
It's included in the not very good Pearl Harbor film with Alec Baldwin portraying James Doolittle. And then they had the Battle of Midway. There was a movie about the Battle of Midway last year where Aaron Eckhart played Doolittle.
Yes.
Which I think is something important too, is with Doolittle's raid, what it also does is sort of set us up for the Battle of Midway, which is such a decisive victory for the United States. I think it sort of sets up, like you said, this huge morale boost, this kind of propagandist boost for us, but it also helps show our allies exactly, now that the U.S. is in it, we're calling the shots, it's our strategy, it's our game, we're going to be setting this war up the way that we want to fight it so that we can win it. I love, though, Doolittle's Medal of Honor citation. If you look at some of these citations, they're really long. They're really detailed. It'll tell you where the troops are and what was going on. Doolittle's is to the point. For conspicuous leadership above the call of duty involving personal valor and intrepidity at the extreme hazard of life, with the apparent certainty of being forced to land in enemy territory or to perish at sea, General Doolittle personally led a squadron of army bombers manned by volunteer crews in a highly destructive raid on the Japanese mainland. That's all you got to say. He did what at that time was seen as impossible. And he did it, and he lived, and he brought back most of his guys with him.
He made the impossible possible, and almost all the guys go on to continue to serve. Many of them stay in the Pacific Theater. Doolittle himself goes to Europe, they all, not all of them survived the war, but it's really a remarkable testament to the character of not only Doolittle, but the men that he gets to go with him, volunteers to go with him on this raid. And the other thing, Doolittle lives a long life. He gets involved in rocket propulsion after the war. He dies in 1993 at the age of 96. However, the one thing I like to mention, I mentioned this very recently, all the 80 guys, unfortunately, none of them are with us any longer. However, the longest lived Doolittle Raider was his co-pilot, a man named Richard Cole, who retires as a lieutenant colonel. Lieutenant Colonel Cole died last year, April of 2019, at the age of 103. He was buried the next month at Arlington Cemetery. So it kind of comes full circle back to Arlington.
Yeah, Doolittle is amazing. Oh, we mentioned two really not very good movies that include Doolittle. But if you want to watch a really good movie about Doolittle's raid, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, it's a 1940s Hollywood movie. Spencer Tracy plays Doolittle. It's one of his best performances. He's sort of the secondary character. Doolittle, it focuses on some of the other pilots played by Van Johnson and Robert Walker. But if you want to, I think, a really good movie about Doolittle's raid, a very classic Hollywood film, I would recommend 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. So ignore some of the more recent 1990s, 2000s movies about this topic and go classic Hollywood.
Yes, I heard the Midway movie was like Doolittle's only in it for like 10 minutes. It's very like brief. And I heard the treatment of it sad and unfortunate. And it's really a very gripping story and how Hollywood could mess it up. I don't know. But yeah, I would go classic Hollywood on this one, too.
I think something too to keep in mind about Doolittle, especially as kind of a compare contrast to Audie Murphy, is like when we're talking about Doolittle's age during World War II, one of his sons also flew in World War II. So he was old enough to have a son who was flying in the war. That's where he was by the Second World War. So very different from a 16-year-old kid.
Oh, yeah, very much. And he was already famous. Like, he had nothing left to prove. He was already
pioneer of aviation.
Pioneer, yes. And he's super famous and would be famous even if the Doolittle Raid had never happened. But then he sort of has this absolutely fascinating moment of glory at the beginning of the war, and it's really great.
And I think some of it ties to what he had done through his career, though, was that proving that we could get those planes there and out, right? Proving that we had global reach, that our pilots could get to any point in the world, and that if you attack the United States, right, we're going to figure out a way. We have the innovation and the ingenuity to figure it out. And I think that's a motivator to psychoanalyze a little bit, because he had pioneered so many areas of flight already. I think the next step was, I want to show them that we can fly there and we can drop a bomb and our guys can do it and they can live to tell the tale.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I absolutely agree.
Wow. Two incredible, really, truly incredible Americans buried at Arlington National Cemetery. And just two stories. There's hundreds of an amazing World War II stories at Arlington.
Yeah. I have a feeling we'll be back to talk about more, not only World War II stories, but multiple stories at Arlington Cemetery. I have a feeling we'll be coming back there again and again. But these are two of my absolute favorites, and I tell them on just about every tour of Arlington that I give.
We will have, we're going to be having a little mini episode coming up soon. We'll be interviewing Erin Miller, whose grandmother was a WASP. We're going to be talking a little bit more about the women who served in World War II on that mini episode and their fight to get honored at Arlington. So if you've enjoyed this episode, make sure that you're subscribed, or better yet, make sure you're a patron and you'll get early access to that interview. But she wrote an incredible book. This is very recent history. These women who were pilots, who were doing a lot of important work, fighting to be honored at Arlington in the same way. So I'm really looking forward to releasing that episode to all of our listeners. And of course, Arlington National Cemetery right now is still closed and will be closed, I'm sure, for the foreseeable future to the public. But they have a lot of great resources online. If you don't follow them, Arlington National Cemetery on Facebook or Instagram, they've been sharing some really great World War II history this month as well. You can also get history related to Doolittle and Audie Murphy and other places. Audie Murphy is included at the National Museum of American History in their Price of Freedom exhibit, which looks at American military history. You can see things that belong to him, like his Bible and some of his dog tags and paperwork. They have some medals of honor on display in that exhibit as well, so you can see a Medal of Honor up close. Doolittle's Medal of Honor was actually donated to the National Air and Space Museum, which they're currently renovating. I hope that maybe they'll put his Medal of Honor on display with the renovation, but we have no idea what's going to be in all the new exhibits. One other thing the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum has that I think is really cool is this tablecloth. Rebecca, do you know about Mrs. Doolittle's tablecloth?
I do not.
So the Doolittles, had a big party after his first all-instrument flight. So that's like 1929. They have this big dinner party to celebrate Doolittle's big aviation achievement. And she had this like white, you know, damask tablecloth as you did back in the day. And, you know, they're sitting around this table with these other important pilots and aviators. And she asked everyone to sign the tablecloth. And she started doing that anytime they had important people from the world of aviation, from the military world. And she collected hundreds of signatures on this tablecloth, and she donated it to the Smithsonian in honor of her husband, which is really, really cool. Kind of recognizing what an important turning point. So people like Charles Lindbergh have signed this tablecloth. Men, other generals and military leaders from World War II, Eisenhower signed the tablecloth. So it's really, really neat.
That's cool. I didn't know that. That's a great little
So you can find some Doolittle and Murphy history around Washington, D.C., not just at the cemetery.
Yes.
Let's see. Anything else?
No, I think for now we're good. This has been, thank you guys so much for coming along with us. I love talking about Doolittle and Murphy. They're super fascinating. And I hope you guys are enjoying. If you enjoyed this and you're not listening to the rest of our World War II coverage, definitely subscribe. You'll get access to all of our pods. We're doing Truman and Churchill and spies, and it's really interesting. And then in June, we've got a whole slate of different podcasts that we're going to talk about. So we're really excited about the pod. It's been a lot of fun to produce and make. Check us out and rate us and review us if you haven't already. That's so helpful and gets the podcast to so many different eyes. If you want to become a patron and get some of these episodes early, as well as special episodes, our Patreon is Tour Guide Tell All. You can engage with us on Twitter at Tour Guide Tell, Facebook page for free tours by foot and DC by foot. We'd love to talk to you. Thank you guys for listening.
Thank you guys so much. Just this month, think about World War II. If you have somebody in your family you can talk to, or someone in your neighborhood, we don't have too many of that generation left. So take a moment to remember the greatest generation as you listen to these episodes. So thank you guys so much. And we appreciate you. We'll see you next time.
Thanks.
Tune in next time on Tour Guide Tell All as Becca continues our series of oral histories on World War II.
The reason we asked you here is your grandmother had a very special role in World War II. I think a role that a lot of people today still aren't always familiar with. So can you tell us a little bit about what your grandmother did during the war?
During World War II, my grandmother served with the Women Air Force Service Pilots, which was the first group of female military pilots for the United States Armed Forces.